Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dale Parrish. My registration number is 11260, and I appear this morning on behalf of Fletcher Enterprises, Conrad Fletcher, Eva Morrison. I would like to begin by addressing our primary concern with the trial proceedings.
Can you raise your voice just a little bit?
Certainly, Your Honor, before Judge Munsinger in Jefferson County. That has to do with a statutory contribution claim that was discussed by the parties in the court before the trial began. The statutory contribution claim was ultimately dismissed at the end of the first day of trial on March 15, 2010, but not until evidence was introduced regarding a completely different contract that was not subject of the plaintiff's claims.
On the contribution issue, I assume the Solid Waste Act requires people who either owned the property or people who contributed to the dumping there to participate in the cleanup.
That's correct.
And so both of these parties had that exposure despite the fact the ownership had changed.
That's correct. Okay. And it followed a condemnation proceeding.
Pardon?
It followed a condemnation proceeding that was initiated.
I understand.
First. So the history is that in 1977, Mr. Fletcher and Mr. Bonilla began working together, and in 1982, the subject property was purchased by Fletcher Enterprises, and they moved their operation from Denver on Colfax out to Adams County, Commerce City. In 1991, Mr. Fletcher stopped work and cared for his wife, who had passed away from cancer later. In the mid-1990s, Adams County decided that they were going to develop the Sand Creek Greenway, and that development included offering to purchase the property at the confluence of Sand Creek and the Platte River from Mr. Fletcher for approximately $100,000. Mr. Fletcher, at that meeting in 1996, indicated that he already had a buyer. His buyer, Salvador Bonilla, Multi-Contractor Services. Mr. Bonilla had testified that it was his dream for 15 years to buy this property. And that happened in 1996. With full notice, Mr. Bonilla knew exactly what he was buying. You may have noticed reference in the record to, "I bought the farm." After 1997, the purchase date of the property, in 2000, condemnation proceedings were begun. And in 2001, in January, Mr. Bonilla, his attorney, Mr. Bradley, who is present in your courtroom today, pardon me, and the defendants and their attorney, Howard Beck, met. This meeting was the split the work agreement that you find repeatedly referenced in the transcript. And it's important to understand that that split the work agreement was a product of these folks coming together and Mr. Fletcher absolutely refusing to pay for any cleanup on that property. He agreed that he would help with the cleanup by working. He had left equipment on the property, and he reasoned that he had no idea of how much dumping had taken place on the property since he had left, stopped working in 1991. Again, this was a meeting that was 10 years later, and Mr. Bonilla, Multi-Contractors, had been using the property and dumping on it those 10 years. Now, at trial, Tom Aker from Commerce City testified that both Multi-Contractors and Fletcher Enterprises had told the city that they had been instructed by Burlington Ditch to place materials in the creek, in Sand Creek, and there is some discussion as to why, storm siphon being washed out. The point is that at the beginning of the trial, I asked Judge Munsinger, please dismiss the statutory contribution claim. Judge Munsinger responds, I'll take that up if and when it is appropriate for me to. And that is on page 16, line 25 of the first day, first volume, March 15. We are asking him to do that because there should be no evidence going to the jury about joint and several liability. It's simply not an issue. It has nothing to do with the split the work agreement that the parties entered into in January of 2001.
Well, wouldn't it be relevant to these parties' continuing efforts to continue working on resolving the issues? Because if one or the other defaults, then they remain jointly and severally liable. So it's not a matter of the trial court instructing the jury that it has to decide the joint and several liability question, but it goes to, you know, motive and the course of dealing.
Yes, Your Honor, it would be relevant to their liability to Commerce City, not to one another. In fact, that very question was asked by a juror, written down on a piece of paper, passed to the jury box, and asked by Judge Munsinger. And we use it as an example of the confusion that took place because of the repeated references to the Commerce City settlement agreement and the joint and several liability in that agreement. Many, many times during the trial, counsel for the plaintiff admitted, "We are not here on a breach of contract concerning the Commerce City settlement agreement." Commerce City wasn't a party. They didn't bring the action. It was admitted that this case, for breach of contract only, was not about that agreement. It's the repeated references to that agreement and the joint and several liability that confused the jury. And their jury questions really reflected that confusion, compounded by the fact that at the end of the trial, there were jury instructions submitted to the jury about joint and several liability. The actual trail of the contract was January 01, we'll split the work. It took a long time for the work to begin. And then in March 2007, the testimony was that Mr. Fletcher, Ms. Morrison, without counsel, went to Mr. Bradley's office with Mr. Bonilla, and that's where the parties disagree about what happened. And I'm not here to argue those facts. I'm not asking you to change your mind about whether or not Mr. Fletcher would all of a sudden say, okay, now I'll pay because I'm too old or I don't have the equipment anymore. That's not the subject of our appeal. What we're trying to show, however, is that you are not allowed to give the jury all of this evidence and testimony about joint and several liability when it's simply not an issue because it's not a part of the contract that was subject of the claim.
But why isn't it, to follow up Judge Fox's question, why isn't it potentially relevant background?
Potentially relevant background.
In other words, you know, it and I respect that is not your theory of the case, but couldn't the existence or, you know, the cloud of that joint and several liability hanging over these people be a possible explanation of the conduct they engaged in 2007?
Well, my first reaction to that is it wasn't offered as such. It wasn't even referred to as such. The time period, Your Honor, that joint and several liability was emphasized was between 2001 and 2007. In 2007, that meeting was offered as a modification of the original split the work agreement.
Well, that's your theory. Their theory is it was a new agreement. So my question is, why isn't evidence of joint and several liability relevant to explain the plaintiff or explain multi-contractors' theory of what happened at this 2007 meeting, which was disputed by the participants?
To answer your question, point on, that period of time that it was used as evidence was the same period of time that Exhibits 10, 11, and 12 were generated, and those exhibits were the side agreements in which the plaintiff was still trying to get Mr. Fletcher to agree to pay for the cleanup. And Mr. Fletcher steadfastly refused to do that. This was after the Commerce City settlement agreement. He said, "I'm not signing an agreement that requires me to pay." They then went to, "Well, we need to have engineering done before you can split the work." And Mr. Fletcher said, "I will pay if I sign an agreement. If I sign, then we have a deal and I will pay." And so the side agreements that he refused to sign were put aside, and then there were two signed writings for two separate payments for Splash Engineering, Mr. Urbanowski's firm. And so You're asking, couldn't it show the party's intent? And my answer is...
No, my question's a little different. Couldn't it show, couldn't the specter of joint and several liability explain the multi-contractor's theory that notwithstanding all these prior refusals, there was an oral agreement to split the costs in 2007?
Couldn't it explain their theory? I suppose it could.
Okay, and if it could explain their theory, isn't it within the trial court's discretion, substantial discretion over relevant evidence?
It is. I do not believe the trial court exercised sound discretion in allowing the joint and several liability jury instructions or evidence in when it was not offered as such by the plaintiff. They didn't say this explains. The plaintiff said, we went to them and said, now it's time to do the work, and they were too old or didn't have the equipment, and so they offered to pay for the work. That is how the evidence was admitted into the court. And Your Honor, that was in 2007. This evidence that you're saying could give some contextual explanation, that was all before 2007. As the trial progressed, that is the sequence in which the evidence was admitted. By the time we got to 2007, they simply said that was a modification. The plaintiff argued that it was a modification of the original split the work agreement. That was the plaintiff's position at trial, that it was a modification. And so they also argued that it was substantial the original split the work agreement was substantially performed by those two written agreements to pay for the engineering. And that was a finding that Judge Munsinger made during the trial. So I hope I've answered your question. It was not in any sense offered as we want to modify the agreement because you entered into this Commerce City settlement agreement. Commerce City never initiated an action saying we're going to hold you responsible. One of the jurors wrote a question, well, what happens if multi-contractors walks away? If they default on the agreement, wouldn't that leave Fletcher holding the bag? And that is the perfect example of the confusion that the jury suffered from, because they were asking about the Commerce City settlement agreement.
Or to allow that, how was it answered? Well, I guess better, to whom was it asked and how was it answered?
I'm sure that the court allowed the question. And I think the answer was that Fletcher would, you know what, I'm not sure of the answer. I don't want to say I can't remember specifically. I would like to resume.
This was a question during during deliberations.
No, after each witness was finished testifying, the court would turn to the jury and ask if they had any questions. They would write them down and pass them through. The equities in the case, if I could very briefly, there's a discussion of the dumping period because the plaintiff was asking for the defendants to be responsible for half of the cost of cleanup. A dumping period was undisputed in the trial record, 9 years roughly for Fletcher Enterprises from 1982 to 1991 when he stopped working. From 1991 to 1996, even before he bought the property, Mr. Bonilla, multi-contractors, dumped on the property, and you may remember the evidence was they measured it against a building on the property, and they could see it getting higher and higher and higher. Then after he bought the property in 1997 to 2007, another 10 years. So 19 years versus 9 years, it's simply not equitable to have the defendants pay half of the expense. And finally, I do want to mention Exhibit 51. Just a travesty for that summary exhibit to be admitted. If you will examine pages 56 through 60, roughly, of the transcript from March 17, you'll find it couldn't have been a summary of documents because there were no documents underlying that exhibit. No payroll records. There were missing receipts. There were missing checks. Several times Mr. Bonilla would just say, well, I know I have it. It's not there, but I know I have it. In his answer brief, esteemed counsel said, well, he stipulated that there were no payroll records. It's true, but a summary of documents requires that it be a summary of actual documents. Those actual documents, the ones that were produced on the day of trial, and there weren't actual documents backing up that summary. Thank you for your consideration.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is Tom Walsh. My attorney registration number is 20017, and I'm attorney appearing on behalf of the plaintiff in this case, Multi-Contractor, who is the appellee. I'm prepared to address multiple issues in this case, but if it pleases the court, I will address the issues focused by the appellant in their oral argument. Specifically, the question that the appellant is pointing to as evidence of the jury confusion, I think if the court examines the record and in light of the court's question, instead demonstrates how clearly the jury understood the relevant issues in this case when they decided the case and ultimately ruled in favor of my client. The question regarding continued liability of the defendants if Multi-Contractor did not complete the work was a jury question that was asked of Mr. Bradley, my client's previous counsel, their counsel during these negotiations. And the question is quoted on page 39 of the opening brief of the appellants. It says, concerning the full responsibility issue with the settlement with Commerce City, if Multi-Contractors did nothing and walked away from Fletcher, would Fletcher be 100% responsible for the settlement or vice versa? He doesn't quote the answer. I don't have the record in front of me. As best I recall, Mr. Bradley said yes. Yes, that was the nature of the joint and several liability. The issue in this case was, did the defendants agree in 2007 to allow Multi-Contractors to do all the work in repairing this property, which previously they had agreed to split the work? Did the defendants agree that Multi-Contractors would do all the work and the defendants would reimburse them for that expense?
That was the full expense or half the expense?
Half the expense. And it's a little more complicated if the court's familiar with the fact, because the way they reimbursed them was by allowing them to miss payments on the outstanding balance of the note. But the issue was, did they agree to pay in that meeting 2007? The testimony from Mr. Bonilla and Mr. Bradley was yes. The written evidence informs a letter from Mr. Bradley to the defendants confirming it, and the letter back from Mrs. Morrison and Mr. Bradley all confirmed it. But Mr. Bonilla said, no, I didn't agree to that, and I never would have. So that was the key disputed issue that this case turned on.
At what point did Commerce City condemn the land?
They never condemned the land. They threatened to condemn the land, and they backed away from it. That's my understanding.
It was still held
by
Multi-Contractors,
correct. So the key issue is, did they agree, did they not? The jury properly... Again, I can only presume what they were thinking, but from their question, it appears they thought to themselves, well, why would they agree to pay that half? Hence the question. If Mr. Bonilla didn't, or Multi-Contractors didn't do the work, would they be 100% potentially on the hook for it? That's their motivation to enter into that agreement or the modification of the existing agreement, and I can address that also. But that's the consideration for agreeing to pay for half. That's why, because they had joint and several liability under the settlement agreement, which stems from their joint and several liability under the Solid Waste Act. I think the appellant's confusion and misreading of this issue is best summarized by their own opening brief on page 36, where they state, quote, the only possible basis for allowing the jury to hear evidence concerning joint and several liability of the parties was a statutory contribution claim. It's simply not true. That was argued at the trial court. I responded, said, no, judge, this is relevant to the consideration. This is relevant to the background. This is relevant to understand what they were considering. Counsel can argue otherwise and did to the jury. He could, and the jury considered his argument, considered my argument, and they reached the verdict that they did. So just to sum that up, Your Honor, I think the jury questions, Your Honors, that jury question explains how well the jury did, in fact, understand the issues in this case in reaching their verdict. With regard to Exhibit 51 that was mentioned briefly by counsel at the conclusion of his argument. I believe we briefed that issue quite thoroughly in the answer brief, explaining that the backup documentation had been produced, that the documentation was there, and that the...
The trial?
No, it had been produced prior, Your Honor. The record, as quoted in the answer brief, was counsel for the defendant said, Your Honor, they can't get this in because they haven't, and I'm paraphrasing, they haven't produced this. And I said, yes, we have, because we had.
Did the trial court make any finding on that?
What the trial court did is they allowed me to put on, have my client testify about the documents. The documents were marked as Exhibit 52, I believe. They were never admitted, but they're the stack of documents. Exhibit 52, I inquired thoroughly of my client about them. They allowed counsel to voir dire about them.
Did you, I apologize, my question may have been imprecise. Did the court make a finding as to whether or not the documents had been produced before trial as Rule 106 would require?
I don't recall, Your Honor, that the court made an explicit ruling in that respect. I think the court made an implicit ruling in that effect because the argument was made and he was allowed to do voir dire. He pointed out the what he perceived to be inconsistencies, one of which he's repeated today regarding the payroll records, and I can address that. And then the court allowed it in and instructed the jury that it had been impeached and they could weigh the credibility of it, so on.
Did your client's testimony go to whether the documents had been made available to opposing counsel before trial or only to the nature and existence of the documents?
Well, I don't know if I can answer that question directly, Your Honor. My client didn't have knowledge of what would have been provided, but the documents themselves were all bait stamped. And that was bait stamping provided by, actually not my firm, because I took this case over shortly before trial, but Mr. Bradley's firm bait stamped all the documents been produced. But there's an admission that was made in the reply brief that I think really short circuits this issue. I think that Exhibit 51 is properly admitted, and I've argued that thoroughly in the answer brief, and we can go into that further. But in the reply brief filed by the appellants on page 39, they state, quote, defendants submit that Exhibit 51, that's the exhibit they object to, and Exhibit A are essentially the same document, in fact, are identical in some respects. So it's an argument I made in my answer brief, and they reiterate in their reply brief that it's the same. Exhibit A was their exhibit that was admitted by stipulation. So if we are incorrect, and the court did make some error in Exhibit 51, and again, not conceding that point, we think Exhibit 51 was properly admitted, they argue that it's the same as Exhibit A, their own exhibit, which was admitted by stipulation. So Exhibit A and testimony of Mr. Bonilla and other exhibits all support the damages, which is what Exhibit 51 goes to. It's a summary of the damages. So it really just completely takes out the issue of whether Exhibit 51 was properly admitted when they're saying Exhibit A, their own exhibit, is the same thing. Just briefly on
that. But without Exhibit 52, I mean, how do we know that Exhibit 51 is a proper summary?
Well, again, as I just said, you don't need to just go there because you can say Exhibit A was let in by there, but by the court's ruling by letting it in. I moved to admit, I'm going on memory now, so I apologize, but I'm going by memory. I moved to admit 52, the documents, and the court said, no, that's not the point of 1006, is that we avoid the admission of voluminous documents by admitting a summary. So the court denied my motion to admit those because they said it's not proper under 1006. So that's the only reason it's not in front of the court. But let me just briefly touch on the payroll records as an example. Exhibit 52 makes reference to monies paid by multi-contractors for workers on the site. And counsel cross-examined my client and said, you don't have payroll records for those. And that we stipulated that there's no payroll records. That's not the only evidence that could support, only documentary evidence that could support the amounts paid to those employees or contractors. The checks, the stack included checks written to those people.
Did the checks comport with the totals in Exhibit 51?
Yes. you added up the totals for each of these individuals and came to those numbers. But there's no payroll records. Grant admitted there's no payroll records. Another similar issue is addressed in the briefs where they're saying there's no receipt for one of the subcontractors. We don't have the receipt. No, we don't have the receipt, but we have the check that paid him. Now, they can impeach and say, well, this is just a check to a third party. How do we know it's connected to this project for this work? Well, that's what he testified to. He said, this is what I paid to these people. So I believe Exhibit 51 really is a red herring in light of the defendant's acknowledgement that other evidence, effectively identical evidence, was admitted by stipulation. The defendants are asking this court to overturn the jury's verdict. They've asserted seven different issues for appeal, three of which asked this court to reverse the jury's verdict based on the trial court's denial of directed verdicts and a denial of a judgment notwithstanding the verdict. The court is aware that in assessing that, the standard review is in taking all the evidence in light most favorable to my client, the same standard applied by the trial court. Is there any evidence? Just ask the court to keep that in mind in assessing those issues. Counsel argues, as he did at trial, while the facts support their theory of the case. And that's fine. That's appropriate at trial. It's not appropriate in front of this court. The burden that the defendants have is to prove that there was no evidence that a reasonable jury could have reached the conclusion that it did. And clearly, there was. Three of their bases for reversal are based on discretion, abuse of discretion by the trial court in admitting evidence or allowing or disallowing a jury instruction. Again, the standard there is abuse of discretion, a very high standard, and suggests that they have not met that. And then the final issue is an outlier regarding the attorney's fees award, abuse of discretion and determination of the amount of attorney's fees. And again, that's fully brief, but the point is the court awarded a nominal amount, $1,300. Our position is the trial court should not have awarded anything, but under the circumstances, we haven't filed a cross appeal. I think the proper determination is that the court's ruling should not be overruled.
Trial court made no findings supporting its $1,300 and some odd dollar amount, correct?
No specific findings, no.
Why shouldn't we remand for findings? Limited to no new evidence, just remand for findings limited to the judge explaining how he got to the $1,300.
You could do that, Your Honor. As I presented in my brief, our position is, I believe it's strongly supported by the case law, that in order to be awarded attorney's fees on a portion of the case, in this case the prosecution of their promissory note claim, they have to apportion the attorney's fees. They have to present some evidence. And counsel's argument to the trial court, and it's in the record, was, I can't do that, Judge. That would be impossible. So I think the law is clear that based upon the requirements, and I wrote down the case, but it's in the brief, the requirements of the case law, that they have to apportion if they're going to seek damages, and their admission to the court that they had not presented any apportionment, and in fact it would be impossible, that the court should have given them nothing. So that's I think that...
I think the law is, under Newport Waste and American Development, I think, is that the court can apportion based on an estimate.
I was citing Fountain versus Mojo, Your Honor. That's the case that says where there's multiple claims, the trial court has to, the party seeking the attorney's fees has to make some effort to apportion it. I apologize, I'm not familiar with the cases that the court's presented, and if those cases allow the court to do that without any evidence from the defendant, then so be it. But I would suggest that wouldn't be logical. The court certainly has discretion to do what it wants, but it has to have some evidence to base that on. And in this case, again, they had no evidence because the defendants offered nothing as to what attorney's fees they incurred with respect to the attorney's fees.
Can't the trial court make that determination on its own from the total amount of fees billed? I mean, the judge knows what portions of the trial roughly were invested in proving the note balance. I mean, yeah, it seems to me what you're suggesting would impose a very heavy, if not impossible, burden on counsel, which would be to say, you know, day one of the trial, I billed my client 6 hours, and the billing records would have to say in 1 hour that was spent proving the note. I mean,
no, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting the defendant, the party seeking the attorney fees, has to provide some evidence. I'm not suggesting.
Including just a self-serving statement in the affidavit that 20% of my fees went to the note.
I don't know that that's self-serving if it's the truth. I mean, if it's truth, they say, look, in light of the nature of the issues in this case, this is what I believe. I might be in front of this court at some point making the argument that that's what I did. So I'm not suggesting that's self-serving if it's the truth. But again, none of that. Counsel's statement to the court was, it would be impossible for me to apportion it. So
I wouldn't just
we stipulated to its existence and the liability. They never presented any evidence of damages. Their disclosures, the court can review the court's file, did not mention how much was owed. It wasn't until they testified at court about what was owed that we stipulated to the existence of the note, the liability of the note is in the pleadings. We can't confess a judgment if they don't tell us what the judgment amount is, and my client always maintained, and the jury agreed, that whatever was owed on the note was far exceeded by what was owed for the repair. So there was no basis after the set-off. Would have been no basis for a judgment first.
Thank you.
Thank you
both counsel for the arguments and briefs. The case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.